Hello and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name's Simon Brew from Film Stories, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive library of over 6,000 films brings together cinema from around the globe. I mean, Alistair Sim in Inspector Calls or Robert Pattinson in Bellamy. How about the hugely acclaimed modern classic Past Lives, a dabble of festivities in Santa Claus the Movie? I might throw in as well David Lynch's The Straight Story or a film that utterly terrified me, 1985's Cat's Eye. This time, we're in the world of Agatha Christie, saluting the 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray debuts of a quartet of film adaptations, each produced by John Braborn and Richard Goodwin. They are 1974's Murder on the Orient Express, 1978's Death on the Nile, 1980's The Mirror Cracked, and 1982's Evil Under the Sun. I'm going to be joined by Agatha Christie historian Dr. Mark Aldridge, the author of books including Agatha Christie on Screen. Before that, here's a taste of the films we're going to be talking about.
Ladies and gentlemen.
My name is Poirot. With Hercule Poirot, mystery is never lost.
Murder is like a jigsaw. You can't see the whole picture.
I am delighted to be welcoming to the Studio Canal Presents podcast Dr. Mark Aldridge, an Agatha Christie expert, and a very warm welcome to you, sir.
Thank you very much. It's always a joy to find an excuse to talk about Agatha Christie films.
Well, we're looking forward to your sleuthing and crime-solving contributions to this podcast. Long overdue, I think. Dr. Aldridge, we like to, just to set the conversation up, just find out a little bit about a guest, get a little bit of film information off them. What was the first film you were taken to see at the cinema? Was it a Christie?
No, it wasn't. No, I actually do remember this quite clearly. We went to see The Jungle Book. I should say not the original release of The Jungle Book. I'm not quite that old. But yeah, I remember we went to see it, and I remember my mum saying that we were going to the pictures, and I didn't quite understand what that meant, and I was like, what does the pictures mean? And then realised what she meant when we got there. So yeah, I remember that really well, actually. I don't remember the film so much as I remember the whole sort of atmosphere and circumstance of going in, getting the tickets, sitting down, getting an ice cream. Like, that was in the interval days, I think, where you know, there was even an interval.
The Jungle Book's, what, 80 minutes? And there would have been an interval in the middle of it. Yeah, yes. Okay. We're an endangered species, Dr. Aldridge, those of us who still call it the pictures, but I'm glad there's two of us still flying the flag. Turning our attention to these four adaptations of Agatha Christie's work, I think to set the scene here, it's probably worth introducing us to the producers, isn't it? John Braborn and Richard Goodwin we've got to thank for this conversation.
It is, yeah, absolutely. So their background has been involved in various things, but she allowed them into her world because Agatha Christie was not happy with film adaptations of her work generally. She liked Billy Wilder's Witness for the Prosecution, and quite right too, because it's an amazing film. But she'd been very unhappy with, like, the Margaret Rutherford films of Miss Marple in the 60s. But yeah, I mean, the story goes that John Braborn sort of contacted her directly, and I suspect that his links to the upper classes and the aristocracy really helped. But he literally phoned Agatha Christie up and said, I'd really like to make a film of Murder on the Orient Express. And she said, oh, well, we could meet at some point in London. And he said, well, can't we meet now? And she said, well, no, I'm sort of an hour and a half from London. He said, oh, that's okay, I'm in the phone booth at the bottom of your garden. That isn't a recommended way, I should say. It would get you arrested these days. Yes, so apparently they got on very well. So he made Murder on the Orient Express. What's funny now about Murder on the Orient Express is that actually one of the things that Agatha and her daughter were very keen at the time was to not make too much of Poirot. That actually they liked having this cast of huge Hollywood stars because it meant that Poirot could sort of, I guess, slightly fade into the background, because I think they were worried about him having to be the star, which is always a problem if you're casting a well-known character, that you've got two people almost battling for attention then, like sort of the real actor and the fictional character. So that seemed to work really well for them. They were really happy with that. So yeah, that's how it all kicked off, was the personal touch.
For those youngsters listening, that's what you had to do in the old days rather than sending a direct message. Like, yes, look them up in the phone book and hide at the bottom of their garden.
Yes.
And so the first of these four adaptations, as you said, was Murder on the Orient Express, comfortably the most acclaimed as well. And, I mean, Sidney Lumet directing.
Yes, I mean, it's the quality makes such a big difference. And that I don't mean that to denigrate George Pollock, who directed, you know, for MGM in the 1960s and stuff. But these are names attached to this film that show that Agatha Christie's being taken really seriously. And I always think about that she'd reached a sort of Charles Dickens point, you know, that you could have Dickens adapted by David Lean or whatever. But Agatha wasn't really given that opportunity so much, with the exception of Billy Wilder's Witness for the Prosecution. But this is the point where people are treating her like part of the cultural heritage, not just
while she was alive.
I mean, she published her last book, her last written book, the year before, 1973. But she never formally said, I'm not writing another book. There was a sort of agreement that she certainly wasn't going to do one for 1974. And there was an expectation that she wouldn't write one again. But she still had ideas ticking over. She went to the premiere of Murder on the Orient Express. You know, she was there.
Can you imagine? Yeah. Can you imagine being sat? If I was Sidney Lumet, I'd be fairly nervous, I suspect. And he's what, the guy who... He was only a couple of years off Serpico, I think.
It's incredible, isn't it? But, you know, that's the appeal. And it's such a strong story with really good characters for a really good cast as well. So they don't get that much to do, but they all get their moment to shine, because the structure of it is everyone gets interviewed one by one, so everyone gets their scene.
It's telling that when Kenneth Branagh attacked the stories, he started in exactly the same place, I think primarily for the same reason, wasn't it?
I think so, and I remember reading that Branagh said that they also had sort of a cast rehearsal in one room, which is quite unusual for films these days, because it's sort of a waste of money, or seen so. I would disagree, I guess. But if you're going to pay for Judi Dench for 2 weeks, you want her to be on camera, for example. But actually, you know, you've got to have a bit of an atmosphere. You've got to make sure these actors know each other and are comfortable for those one big scenes where they're all together.
I mean, I read that Sidney Lumet's tactic when it came to casting wasn't actually to cast Hercule Poirot first, it was to give his old mate Sean Connery a ring.
Yes, that's absolutely true. Yes, so he was the first of the big names attached. I think Anthony Perkins might have been next. And there are various people who, I guess, he went through his phone book and saw who might be interested. But that was the idea, was that if you got a couple of big names attached first off, then you can say to people, look, there is no one star. Like, the train is the star, really. Agatha Christie is the star. But this is going to be a really nice project to be a part of.
I mean, you mentioned Dame Judi Dench just before there. Dame Judi Dench made headlines when she won a Best Supporting Actress Oscar for less than 10 minutes of screen time. And in the case of Murder on the Orient Express, I mean, someone got to the trick first, Ingrid Bergman.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Which, again, shows that it's a really good way for people to have their little showcase, you know, for a moment of their attention. And if you make enough of an impact, I mean, I think Oscars are nonsense anyway. It's just like, why would you care?
I'm inclined to agree, unless I win one, in which case they're brilliant.
That's true. Yeah. But every year when I see all the news reports, I'm like, why do you care what a bunch of people who live in Hollywood who you're never going to meet think is the best film of the year? What's that got to do with you? You know, I care what I think is the best film of the year, as far as I'm concerned. I'm not bothered about anybody else. Maybe that's a bit self, I know.
We're going to collaborate on a Christie adaptation in the future. We'll be on the Oscar stage, and my speech to you, Dr. Aldridge, will be reminding you of this moment.
maybe.
I also want to note as well that one of the other people who got six Oscar nominations this film got, Jeffrey Unsworth, who shot 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, and it's beautiful, and it's got, yes, the cinematography is great, especially that the opening flashback sequence is so striking. The music's fantastic as well. It's a really prestigious film, you know. It's in the proper sense, as in you can tell that this has got a lot of attention from top tier people, and it's got a budget. You know, you don't have to make an Avengers movie, you don't have to make a superhero movie to use your budget well. Sometimes it can just be about every shot, every scene looking and sounding and being performed as well as it can be.
Agatha Christie herself, her review of the film, thumbs up, thumbs down?
Thumbs up.
What a relief.
Yes, so there is the story, yeah, that she... She only criticised the moustache, that she thought that Albert Finney's moustache should have been better. I don't know how true that is. I know that...
It's a lovely story, though, isn't it?
That she was certainly happy enough with it, you know, that it was... she wasn't upset by it, which is about as good as you can get, really. And I know that Rosalind, her daughter, who was dealing with a lot of the affairs, of course, by this time, because Agatha was in her 80s, she was happy with it too, although not Sean Connery. She didn't think Sean Connery was great, yeah. But other than that, she was really happy. And I think there was just that sort of sigh of relief that it had all worked out okay in the end, that it hadn't gone the way of the sort of comedy of MGM.
I mean, just to tie this first of the four films out, I mean, you touched on him there, Albert Finney as Hercule Poirot, the only time he would play the role. Just tell us a little bit about him in the film and why he wouldn't come back for Death on the Nile.
So there were quite a few names that they went through. I think Alec Guinness, I would say. But there's quite a lot of names that they were considering. And Albert Finney was sort of, he's one of those actors that was on the first list and then they dropped him. And then as they got through it, they were like, oh, yeah, sort of kept going back to thinking about Albert Finney. But obviously he was too young for the role, so he had to be made up to look a bit older. But he was also performing on stage at the time. So he used to be transported by ambulance, I believe, first thing in the morning, so he could lie down, you see, and they could put the makeup work or start his makeup on his way to set.
What, in the ambulance?
Yeah. I mean, I presume this is not an actual medical ambulance, by the way, as in not they haven't stolen it from a hospital, but presumably a sort of converted or... But the point was is that he could lie down flat.
They can't sue us now, Dr. Aldridge, we're safe.
So, yeah, he was a bit... But, I mean, what a name for it, because, again, it's bringing Agatha into the modern age. You know, he's known for the sort of the... Obviously, those British, slightly gritty films of the early 60s in particular. So to bring him in to be the star of an Agatha Christie film, or one of the stars, is, I think, quite telling about where the film industry was, as well as what they were trying to do with Agatha Christie.
Oh, that's interesting. And where was the film industry at that point?
Well, there was lots of news reports that talk about whether Murder on the Orient Express might be the saviour of the British film industry, because it was so... I mean, it's difficult in retrospect because you say, oh, it was in the doldrums, and you go, but then there were loads of films I love from the early 70s, late 60s. But it definitely was struggling to, I guess, place itself on the world map and do that thing of being distinctively British whilst also being commercial. And I think Agatha Christie really helps to set up these sort of prestige dramas that we see, of course, a lot of in the 80s in particular, all the sort of E.M. Forster adaptations and then Jane Austen adaptations and all these sorts of things, which is where the British film industry, you know, starts to look at its own heritage, these heritage movies like Chariots of Fire and so on. I think you can see the genesis of them with something like Murder on the Orient Express, that the British film industry goes, aha, this is something we do really well that nobody else can really do. Let's lean into that a bit more.
Now, younger me remembers being surprised when Val Kilmer was replaced as Batman after one film. And we went to, Val Kilmer in Batman Forever, George Clooney to Batman and Robin. When your film's been a commercial success, won an Oscar, been nominated for five more, and the lead role is recast for the next movie. Was that as impactful then as it sounds now?
So there was never any serious suggestion that Albert Finney would return. He's not the sort of actor who's... I remember that thing about Meryl Streep saying, that Meryl Streep doesn't do sequels, although she does now. But
yes,
but for a long time, and I suspect that was the same with Albert Finney. He's done it. Why would he want to come back and do another one? Also, I know that he wasn't a great fan of doing the makeup, which I suspect is another reason. But I don't think there were ever any serious talks with Albert Finney about coming back, because I don't think that was realistically on the table. And actually, if you watch certainly Death on the Nile, but more definitely Evil Under the Sun, then Peter Ustinov's Poirot actually sits in those worlds much more comfortably than Albert Finney's does, because they're not as dark. And I feel like for both of those stories, Poirot has to be able to get on with people. Like, they're both holiday movies. Yeah. And I'm not sure that Albert Finney's Poirot ever really would. That he's always going to be a bit sort of outside of everyone else. So, which is very true to the original novels, by the way. But yeah. I think that actually the more amiable, the more sort of light, I guess, Peter Ustinov works for those later films. But yeah, there were a few news reports at the time, and actually the official line was, I was unaware that it was required that we had to retain cast members from the previous films. It's basically what the producer said in one of them. So in other words, we don't have to do it if we don't want to.
So moving to like 1978's Death on the Nile, I look at the poster of it and the top billed name on it is Agatha Christie. Mm-hmm. And I do wonder if part of the fluidity of the casting was down to the fact that it was always going to be seen as Agatha Christie rather than, when you look at the cast list, just a Death on the Nile, Peter Ustinov, Bette Davis, Mia Farrow, George Kennedy, Angela Lansbury, Maggie Smith. And yet it's Agatha Christie at the top of the poster.
Yeah, she is the star of it. You know, she's the star of loads of these movies because she has constructed these tales that actually lend themselves so well to this bit of Hollywood glamour. Wherever it may be set, it's always sort of the Hollywood sense of glamour to it, whether they're British stars or not. And I think that with Death on the Nile, there's a bit of a reaffirmation of that. That, bear in mind, Agatha Christie dies in 1976, and inevitably there's a bit of resurgence in interest, although there had never been a lack of interest, but perhaps people were more minded to go, oh, there's Agatha Christie. But, I mean, you'll also notice on that poster about the emphasis on Egypt and the Nile, and there was this big exhibition in New York, which had already been in London, I think, where, you know, Tutankhamun's mask, I think, and various artefacts from Egypt were on tour. So there, it was a bit of a craze for Egypt in the 1970s anyway, around this time. So actually Egypt's the star too, as well as Agatha Christie, as well as all the cast.
Well, they didn't get Sidney Lumet back either for the film. John Guilliman, wasn't it?
Yes, it is, yes.
It's known for The Towering Inferno.
Which, of course, has got an all-star cast.
Yes.
And actually, I really don't think is a million miles away in terms of the what you've got to juggle, that you're juggling a lot of practicalities as well as a cast who might be difficult. But I don't think were, actually.
When you say might be difficult, are you hedging your bets a little bit there?
Well, I mean, it's Bette Davis. There's this whole thing about, you know, I didn't go to the Nile comes to me and all that sort of thing. but she did. And the whole thing is that everyone was quite nervous around her. And then there was a scene, I think with Peter Ustinov, David Niven and her, where she kept forgetting her lines. And said, oh, I'm sorry, I'm so nervous because I barely got any sleep because I was up all night learning my lines because I didn't want to mess up in front of you two. So it's sweet that everybody had gone into that scene quite nervous because both Ustinov and Niven had been very nervous about it because of Davis's reputation. I think that it was all quite nice. And Angela Lansbury said that she had a lovely time sightseeing as well. So why not, eh?
Well, Angela Lansbury sneaking into the ensemble early. It's like someone, I don't know, popping into an early episode of Doctor Who and then being cast as the Doctor like 10 years later, isn't it? I mean, we didn't really talk much about the breadth of the ensemble cast of Murder on the Orient Express, but this is repeated right across these four films. Can you give us a flavour of Death on the Nile?
So, yeah, well, we're talking about old school Hollywood names such as Betty Davis, but also up-and-coming names. I mean, Maggie Smith obviously had already been known for things like Prime Minister Jean Brodie and so on.
Yeah.
But alongside both of them, there are sort of younger members of the cast who will go on to do more things later. Oh, names fail me, of course, just as I'm sort of saying this. But you see this with all of the films, all four of them, that there are people who might have been successful.
Well, Celia Imrie's
Celia Imrie with her, like, she's like a maid at the beginning of Death on the Nile, isn't she? And she actually told an interview story about how she had deliberately positioned herself in a way to make sure that she got on camera. And quite right too, it worked. Well done. Here we are, all these times later. But all of these films, they're sort of looking, because they're also people drawn from fashion, drawn from music, a really good, interesting variety of people to attract, I guess, a wide audience. You know, you don't want to have 8 or 10 or 12 guest stars who are all appealing to the same people. You want to bring them from elsewhere.
And what was the reception to it like? Was it as strong as Murder on the Orient Express?
The basic trajectory of these movies, unfortunately, is that everyone performed about half as well as the previous one. Now, Murder on the Orient Express performed extraordinarily well. It was a massive hit. So to go from that to Death on the Nile being half as big is not as big a drop as you might think. Like, it's still doing really well. People tend... there are a few critics who thought it was too long. And I can understand that because the murder comes in quite late in the novel and in the film.
Yeah.
I love it. I mean, I think Death on the Nile is a better film than Murder on the Orient Express, or at least one that I enjoy watching more. But I am sympathetic to the fact that it is like 2.5 hours long, which for some people is a bit long for a murder mystery. So I understand why someone might think that. But for me, I think it's at least as good, if not a smidge better, than Murder on the Orient Express. And I think over time has gone on to be loved in a way perhaps a slightly more broadly than the slightly harsher feel of Murder on the Orient Express has, which I think is sort of the critic's choice, and Death on the Nile and Evil Under the Sun tend to be the popular choices.
So if I'd have rocked up at the cinema expecting to see a third Poirot film, why didn't I get one? Why did I get a Miss Marple one, The Mirror Cracked?
So the idea was that they wanted to broaden out a bit and that they were going to alternate so that you would have every other year you'd have an Agatha Christie movie and they'd alternate between Poirot and Miss Marple. But because of the trajectory that I mentioned, as in the profits kept going down, that was cut short somewhat. So we did get The Mirror Cracked in 1980, which is a notably less expensive film than the previous two, and actually notably less expensive than Evil Under the Sun, which comes afterwards.
Yeah.
So of the four, the one that perhaps has had the least attention to detail paid to it within the production. I think that it's slightly flat. And again, it's a film I really enjoy, but it doesn't quite have that energy to it that the other movies managed to provide. And that...
Oh, you say that. I want my Angela Lansbury Miss Marple series. I feel denied.
That's what people wanted at the time. But at the time, they also had a rough commission and said that one of the bigger networks was interested in doing 60 episodes. And then Agatha Christie Limited pointed out, quite rightly, that there aren't 60 Miss Marple stories, and they weren't at that time allowing people to do anything original. And then we end up with Murder, She Wrote a couple of years later, which is not a coincidence.
No, I didn't think it was.
No. But it's a lovely... And I think, actually, Angela Lansbury is much... And I love her. I'm a huge Angela Lansbury fan. And I think that she is much better as Jessica Fletcher than she is as Miss Marple. I don't think she's ever quite comfortable.
Well, she's more mobile and less injured, isn't she?
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know that she ever quite cracks... She said this in her autobiography, that she never quite felt that she cracked the character. And I think she's hampered by her makeup and hair as well to make her look older. And I think that creates a little bit of distance between us as the audience and her as Miss Marple. So it's not a bad performance by any means. She's never given a bad performance, never did. But it doesn't quite come together as well as the others.
You say that. I really enjoyed The Mirror Cracked. I hadn't seen it before. And I'm sat watching it. I was just like, hang on, it's Elizabeth Taylor. Where the hell has she come from?
Who never gets that big scene with Angela Lansbury that you're dying for. Because the script demands that they are kept separate. Yeah. Because otherwise Miss Marple's going to work it out too quickly. So she can't speak to lots of the cast very much. Which is why she's given, you know, an injury early on to keep her away from the action. But you're dying for that scene. You know, you desperately want Elizabeth, I mean, yeah, from National Velvet, all those years earlier, you've got Elizabeth Taylor and Angela Lansbury back together. And, well, I mean, I don't want to spoil it, but they don't
it's
ever
like
get
It's like De Niro and Pacino in The Godfather Part 2, isn't it? It's like keeping the legends apart.
Exactly,
I mean, I'm assuming the slightly muted reaction that you've implied to The Mirror Cracked is what curtailed the idea of doing more Miss Marple films.
Yes, so they did. There was an announcement sort of buried in the trade press, just as an aside, really, that said that the plan was to do At Bertram's Hotel next. So, which is a 1960s story, and it's a really interesting one, but it's very, again, you could do it on the cheap if you wanted to, because it's also mostly set in a hotel. It's contemporary-ish, more contemporary than others, maybe. And then actually lots of it is about sort of a big conspiracy that's going on. So it's a slightly different type of story to your traditional whodunit. So you could see how it could work, but that didn't get very far. It was really with Evil Under the Sun. If Evil Under the Sun, which was the fourth one, bucked the trend and had gone up, I think, then they probably would have done a Miss Marple. And we would have got a Bertram's Hotel. But because it continued the downward trend at the box office, and I believe, I mean, it's difficult to put your mind back into the time, but the sense generally was that they were starting to feel a bit tired anyway, that their moment of these sorts of films had passed. Which happens, you know, things move in and out of fashion.
I should note that, I mean, you've brought in Evil Under the Sun, which came in 1982, which brought Poirot back, but also that and The Mirror Cracked, both directed by Guy Hamilton, best known for James Bond films.
Absolutely is, yes. And, you know, I'm slightly critical of his direction of Mirror Cracked, which, like I say, which, by the way, finished under budget, if you've ever heard of a film doing that. So if there's ever a sign that a film was not stretching its ambitions, then it's that. But Evil Under the Sun is mostly filmed on Mallorca, which is coincidentally where Guy Hamilton lived, or not at all coincidentally. I mean, everyone's having a great time on that, and that is much fresher. That you can feel the energy in that film is much, much stronger. It's my favourite, actually, of the four. I just think it's so funny, so fun, such a good story. I love it. It's my sort of desert island film. And if I had to just watch one film, it probably would be that.
I watched it for the first time last night, and it's got written all over it, one for the fans.
Yes.
It's like making a Marvel movie where they bring in everybody you want to see just for the fan. I found it absolutely mad and a complete blast.
Good.
I was almost disappointed when the murder mystery came in, because I was just, because it's quite a way in, isn't it? And I just wanted to spend time with Maggie Smith in that film.
Her and Diana Rigg together, I mean, it's just a joy. What more can you want? Marvellous.
I wrote down Peter Ustinov's Poirot, never knowingly underplayed.
Absolutely, yeah. And you can see Albert Finney's not going to work in that movie, right? I couldn't even imagine him in sunlight, to be honest, let alone doing everything else Poirot does.
Just to round this up, I mean, I just rank them for it. I don't usually do this. I'm turning into an internet clickbait merchant. Because most people, I think, will do them in order. Murder on the Orient Express, Death on the Nile, Mirror Cracked, Evil Under the Sun. Let's have the authoritative Dr. Aldrin.
People will chase me now. Okay, so, but for me, though, it's very clear. For me, it is Evil Under the Sun at the top, Death on the Nile second, Murder on the Orient Express third, and I think they are all very good movies in very good ways. And then for me, there is a gap, and then it's The Mirror Cracked at the bottom. And that is almost entirely down to the direction, which I just think is quite uninspired. But it's nice to have Miss Marple, and it's a great story, but it doesn't quite have the energy to it that the other three manage to provide.
The Agatha Christie collection is available now, both individually and in a deluxe collector set on 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray. That's what I'm watching over Christmas. Dr. Aldridge, before we let you go, though, one thing we ask of our guests is that you dig a bit deeper into the Studio Canal collection for us and pick out a double bill, particularly as we're coming out just before Christmas. What should we be curling up to watch?
The two that I've picked are, number one is Flash Gordon, which when I got my 4K TV this year, that was the first thing I watched on it in 4K.
Brian Blessed booming out.
Could you imagine anything better? All those colours, all the effects, it looks gorgeous. And it's actually a movie that I didn't really watch as a kid, and I actually sort of experienced properly as an adult, and I was like, this is so much fun. So it's become one of my comfort views. So that would be one. My other one, I don't know if this is cheating because it's a TV series, but it's The Avengers. Currently with my partner, we are rewatching them in random order. because otherwise you spend so long. It's not a serial, right? And so it means that you get to watch a bit of Kathy Gale, watch a bit of Emma Peel, a bit of Tara King, a bit of, you know, whatever's coming out. So that's a really fun way to do it. I recommend it, by the way. And also, to give Studio Canal their props for a moment, but is that I remember when they used to look awful and they always looked brown. And when a few years ago they remastered them, it was just like, oh my God, all these colours. So they're a real pleasure to watch now in a way that used to be a bit more hard work.
The Avengers and Flash Gordon are both available on the Studio Canal Presents channel on Apple TV and Prime Video. Flash Gordon also available on 4K disc, a copy of which is sitting in Dr. Mark Aldridge's house. Dr. Aldridge, this has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Simon. It's a pleasure.
There's just time for a little bit of news from the rest of the world of Studio Canal. Let's start with James McAvoy's directorial debut, California Scheming. Based on Gavin Bain, Straight Out of Scotland, it's the story of a pair of Scottish friends who pretend to be American rappers as they try and break into the record industry. Headlined by Samuel Bottomley and Seamus McLean Ross, with McAvoy himself taking on a role, the movie's heading to cinemas on the 10th of April 2026. And here's a taste of the trailer.
Your silver brains!
Where are you from?
LA.
LA?
Woo! The next Snoop, Wu-Tang Clan, the next Eminem.
And they actually think you're American?
Yeah!
But your accents are pure shite.
I know!
If we're going to do this, we need to commit. That means no more Scottish.
Och, away.
Man, I'm being serious. We got to become Syllable and Brains.
Are you ready?
I'm ready. Are you ready?
I'm freaking ready. Let's go.
Another big cinema release to mark for you as well. How to Make a Killing is the next feature for Hollywood star Glenn Powell. This time about a man disowned by his wealthy family at birth. But that's not going to stop him from trying to claim his inheritance, no matter how many obstacles are thrown in his direction. John Patton Ford directs this one, with the film landing in UK cinemas on the 27th of February 2026. Here again is a brief taste of what's in store.
Since the day I was born, my mother told me we were different. Yes, she had been disowned by her family. But someday I would become the sole heir. The real estate, planes, an island or two.
Beckett, no way. So are you living in the city now?
Yeah, I do. A little outside of it.
Whatever happened to the Redfellow family fortune?
I'll inherit it. Someday.
Finally, the breakout box office hit, I Swear, one of the most acclaimed films of 2025, is available now to watch on premium video on demand. Telling the story of John Davidson, MBE, I Swear is already an award-winning film, and it's also heading to DVD and Blu-ray from the 29th of December. Mm-hmm. This is our final episode of Studio Canal Presents this year. So if we catch you in time for Christmas, we'd like to wish you a wonderful festive period from myself and from Queenie, our producer. I'll be back soon with the next episode of Studio Canal Presents. Until the next time, to get all the news on Studio Canal films as it happens and to find out more about the Apple TV and Prime Video channels, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on X, Instagram and TikTok. Till the next time, I'm off to solve a couple of crimes.